This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Van Leer Institute series on ideas. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host, and I'm pleased to welcome Amy Guida to the show today to talk about her important new book, Seek and Hide, The Tangled History of the Right to Privacy. Amy Guida is the perfect person to address this issue, since she's both a professor of law at Tulane Law School and a former journalist, as well as one of the country's top experts on privacy in the media. She was an award-winning legal commentator on Illinois public radio stations, has written for the New York Times and for Slate, and provided expert commentary for the New Yorker, as well as many other publications. Amy lives in New Orleans. Amy Guida, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Before we begin to talk about your book, tell us a little bit about yourself. Was there someone or something that strongly influenced your intellectual development, and particularly your interest in this topic specifically?
I wouldn't say that there was a particular person, but working as a journalist over a number of years, I came to recognize this conflict between truth and privacy at times. So in other words, I would find out information about people that I considered private, and I would make the call not to report that information. And what I found interesting was that when I became a law student and then a lawyer, I came to understand that the law also protects people's privacy in this way. And so even though I was making ethics decisions back in the day, the law also recognizes privacy. And so I think that's really a big motivation for me. This is the area that I study. I study defamation as well, but I'm particularly interested in privacy because of this conflict between truth and press freedom and all those good things, but then also an individual's right to privacy, the right to keep something secret.
And now that you've been accomplished in both those professions, does the conflict between the right to privacy and freedom of the press look different to you depending on which hat you wear?
Yeah, I would say that's a really wonderful question, and I would say yes. And this isn't the thing that comes to mind. Earlier this summer, when the Dobbs opinion was leaked to the media, thinking about this as a lawyer and a law professor, I was horrified that someone would do something like this. But thinking about it as a journalist, I was intrigued and, of course, wondered who had leaked it and certainly would have done the same thing as did Politico in publishing the document that was somehow given to them. So I think it's that sort of that conflict then was very apparent to me back this summer when the Dobbs opinion was leaked.
Well, the leaking of the Dobbs opinion was one big issue. But what are the implications of the Dobbs decision for Americans' right to privacy?
That's a really great question. And it depends on how you define privacy, at least in looking at the Dobbs opinion. People are, of course, very concerned that all the decisions by the Supreme Court that built on Roe versus Wade and Griswold before it, marriage equality, cases like that could come tumbling down in a post-Dobbs world. The court suggested that a constitutional right had to appear in the text of the Constitution or be deeply rooted in the nation's history and traditions. And because of that, and the way they looked at abortion and autonomy and privacy in that sense, certainly it put all of those rights in danger. But what's interesting to me, beyond my worries about Dobbs, is that the court differentiated between that type of privacy, that type of right, the right to make and implement important personal decisions. So the right to decide to have an abortion without governmental interference, versus the right to shield information from disclosure. And so, in other words, even as it crushed this notion of privacy in the ability to decide whether or not to have an abortion, it suggested that there was another different type of privacy, this right to shield information from disclosure. And so in that sense, even though we think about Dobbs doing away with privacy more generally, it doesn't. And the court suggests that, in fact, it might look at that right to shield information from disclosure differently. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future. I'll mention one interesting case. That's several months before the Supreme Court decided the Dobbs decision. It suggested that there would be a privacy interest in certain data points. And what that case was it involved a tax law that had been passed in California. And that law ordered charities to reveal donors to the state. And those charities didn't want to reveal who the donors were. And so the case went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And there, the justices, the same justices that decided Dobbs, suggested that there would be privacy in that sort of information. They literally said that there were privacy interests in things like home addresses. And they were particularly worried about doxing in that scenario, the revelation of personal information about people on the internet. And the suggestion that people should go to others' homes to protest. And so they were very worried about the revelation of those data points. And I think that suggests that indeed, if the court were to decide a case involving this right to shield information from disclosure, it would look at it very differently from the way it looked at the Dobbs decision. So by my read, Dobbs does not do away with privacy more generally. It troublingly does away with this this particularized right to abortion in that sense. But it looks at that other type of privacy, I would argue, very differently, even though arguably they both have the same foundations in this right to be let alone, that sort of sensibility.
And there's another way of looking at privacy, or another type of privacy, I'm not sure if the law considers it, but anyone with a heart had to cheer when Alex Jones of InfoWars lost the libel case against him and had to pay millions of dollars in damages. But he had been free for years to abuse bereaved parents of murdered children for profit before being held accountable. Is this the best the law can do to protect what I'm suggesting is the privacy of vulnerable crime victims and their families?
So that's a really intriguing question as well. When I talk with my students about privacy, I don't talk about it only in this sense that I just mentioned, this right to shield information from disclosure. It also touches on another tort, another legal wrong, that is intentional infliction of emotional distress, or negligent infliction of emotional distress. That sensibility that you suggest existed in the parents, not so much just in a defamation sense in ruining their reputations, but in also harming them emotionally. And more recently, back in the 70s and 80s, it was very difficult to win one of these emotional distress cases. And the reason why was because of the interest in the First Amendment on the other side. So the suggestion that, you know, what we wanted to celebrate freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and therefore it was very, very difficult for anyone to try to argue that speech had harmed them emotionally, because courts were very interested in protecting speech over emotions. You know, the thought was get a thicker skin. More recently, because of what's happened on the internet, courts are much more amenable to accepting these emotional distress claims. And so in cases like that, my suggestion here is that that courts are looking to things other than reputation and suggesting that the law should protect people who've been harmed in those ways. And you see that beyond just that sort of loss. I'll give you an example. There's a fairly recent case involving a parent who had her child's autopsy report released to the media. And she sued for an invasion of privacy. She sued for the right to privacy, and she was successful there. And in that case, the court again suggested that that there's a privacy in death that can lead to deep emotional harm if in fact information about that death is released. And so that too is a way the law is changing. And I relate it very much with what's happening on the internet, the revelation of death images, the revelation of, deep, emotionally relevant video that might be released, and court's recognition of the long-lasting harm that can come from that information being revealed in the first place, but then also remaining on the internet for a very, very long time.
Is there a difference in this emotional arena between societies that view privacy as a question of dignity, such as Great Britain, and the U.S., which sees it in the context of liberty, freedom, and the freedom of the press?
Well, I think that recently, again, more and more courts, when they are deciding privacy cases, are suggesting, are using sometimes the word dignity. And so again, in the early days, when I say early days, what do I mean? I mean the 70s, the 80s, and the early 90s. It was very much about freedom, and yet through these examples that I've just mentioned and others, some of which literally use the word dignity, I suggest that we're moving in the United States toward that model of at least thinking about dignity in a privacy sense in deciding these sorts of cases.
Well, each point of view can enable a certain kind of abuse. But talk about the abuse that the privacy, too much privacy, can afford.
Sure. So what I like to what I like to think about when I think about that that issue is back in the very early days of the United States in the 1700s. Two founders, John Adams and William Cushing, got together, were writing letters to each other, and they were discussing the First Amendment. And there was the suggestion, of course, that the First Amendment would promise freedom of the press, freedom of speech. And they were concerned about this because they thought that there would be that some men had secrets that should remain secret and not be revealed by the press. And they called these secrets instances of male conduct. And what that meant was sexual dalliances outside of marriage. And so Cushing writes to John Adams and says, you know, we have this First Amendment that promises freedom of the press. Could this mean that the press would be able to publish instances of male conduct, including instances of male conduct by politicians? And John Adams replied, oh no, that's not the sort of thing that the First Amendment would protect. So this suggestion that very in the earliest days of the United States, that there would be privacy for politicians in these instances of male conduct. And you see that throughout the course of history. Thomas Jefferson attempted to put in jail, and successfully did, a newspaper editor who reported that he was having a sexual relationship with one of the women he had enslaved, Sally Hemings, moved to Grover Cleveland. Grover Cleveland had a number of issues in his life, including early sexual dalliances again, and why he particularly asked for privacy when he was president was that he began dating and thereafter married a young woman he was the foster father to. So he'd helped raise her from the time her father died when she was 13. And when she turned 18, he started dating her and begged for privacy in that relationship. And you see that sort of protection for privacy in politics even today. And the example that I use in my book is the fact that even though a lot of people really want to see Donald Trump's tax returns, we still have not seen those tax returns, even though people have them. And one of the reasons his lawyers have made the argument that those tax returns are private. And so when there's this specter of privacy, many times it shuts people down. You know, look to see the number of times when a politician or a public figure requests privacy when something big happens in their lives. You know, oh, we must, you know, please give us privacy. That privacy then can prevent very important reporting from happening. And it refers, in a sense, not only to law, but also the ethics provisions that I talked about initially. those reasons why journalists and other publishers may decide not to publish something that the public would be particularly interested in. But if we decide, we as journalists decide that the news value is not as significant as the person's interest in privacy, that might not ever be reported. And so again, while we have this trend in the United States moving to embrace privacy more, not in a Dobbs sense, but in this right to shield information from disclosure, it's a dangerous time because journalism is in trouble financially, and certainly it can be chilled by the specter of a privacy lawsuit being brought against a journalist for reporting truth that a politician or a public figure might consider private, and truth that then could become the basis for an invasion of privacy claim.
Some writers, most notably George Orwell in 1984, and actually some writers before him, described a world of total transparency, which was conflated with totalitarianism. That is, lack of privacy is somehow associated with totalitarianism. Are they necessarily linked?
So when you suggest this, it brings to mind this how people respond to privacy, and especially privacy with regard to government. And before I talk about that a little bit, let me just say that that now for 2 years I've asked my big first year law class, my torts class, whether they fear government knowing their information or public companies. So companies knowing information about them. And when I first started teaching privacy 20 years ago, the real concern was government and what government knew. And the concern was cameras on telephone poles watching every move of the people on the street. For the past 2 years, at least, that has flipped. And now my students are far less concerned about what the government knows about them. They recognize that there are cameras on the street. They recognize, in fact, they say that that they are recorded by government from the time they leave a building until they get home. This doesn't worry them as much as what they feel is surveillance from private companies when they access the internet, and what data those companies know about them. Again, you know, maybe they recognize that the government might have the right to that information too, if someone convinces a judge to sign a warrant for that information. But I find it fascinating that these young people today are far less worried about what the government knows about them, and much more concerned about what private companies might do with the data that's generated about them, either by themselves through social media or inadvertently through interacting in the internet or with the internet through cookies and otherwise.
And that's corporate, the threat of corporate invasion. But the data that is available, for example, DNA data, you can't get more personal than that. There are bad actors on the internet as well. There are hackers who steal intimate financial and health data. And of course, there is the horrors of revenge porn that is out there. how do the courts look at those issues?
So intriguingly, revenge porn is going to be something that's separate. So let me first talk about I'll first talk about data privacy and the very intriguing things that are happening now in the United States with regard to that. Congress has yet to pass a data privacy law. So data privacy legislation is just not happening on the national level. Intriguingly, however, some states like California and Illinois, to name two, have passed really comprehensive data privacy legislation. And because of these really powerful laws, attorneys have brought successful class action lawsuits against social media companies. So, for example, one that comes to mind argued that if a company was scanning the internet for faces, and thereafter figuring out what person belonged to what face, so putting together a name with a face, that could be a privacy invasion because of this data privacy statute, biometrics privacy, and data privacy. And so these state statutes and these class action lawsuits have been the drivers then of data privacy in the United States. And what I think is really interesting about that is that even though Congress hasn't taken a step toward this yet, it hasn't enacted legislation, these states have, and they've made companies that that retain data, they've made those companies then be very fearful about using that data in a way that would violate those statutes. And so the prediction is, and this is not my prediction, this is what privacy officers at companies suggest, that within the next 5 years, that because of these state statutes and because of these lawsuits that have charged these companies with millions and millions of dollars in fines, that within 5 years, the United States will have a much more European sensibility with regard to data privacy. So we'll begin to follow then the GDPR protection for data, as opposed to the much more willy-nilly protection for data that exists in the United States, at least on the federal level. So I think that's really intriguing. You know, you might think that that a law in California might not have much power to protect people outside of California residents, and yet that law, along with the class action lawsuits that have been brought under it and similar laws in other states, have really made a change, the privacy officers say, with regard to their view of the need to protect data and not use it. The other intriguing thing is this shift, and probably what happens is these companies recognize now exactly what I suggested, that my students, the young people today, care very deeply about privacy and are very aware of the potential for privacy invasions, especially with regard to their data. And so they're marketing themselves as being very privacy sensitive. And one of the ways to do that is by suggesting that they will protect the data just as strongly as the data is protected in Europe. And using that as some marketing scheme, so that young people will begin to trust these companies. So I find that that incredibly, incredibly intriguing, and also very hopeful. Even though we can't get Congress to do it, it seems that state legislatures and courts are taking action where Congress hasn't.
That's really very encouraging. That prediction is encouraging, and I hope it's correct, because the pendulum has swung very far in the other direction.
That's right. And there was this notion, too, initially, the way courts were deciding these cases involving data privacy, there was the suggestion that, hey, if you interact on the internet, you're agreeing to share the information with someone. That means the information can be used however the company you've interacted with wants to. You're willingly sharing that information. Well, there's been an about face over the course of the past past couple of decades or so with regard to that, certainly.
That's good news. I'm very interested in the notion that you describe in your book, that privacy is essential for creativity and spirituality, that liberty entails the protection of those human functions. So tell us about what Justices Warren and Brandeis said about it in the Harvard Law Review article, The Right to Privacy.
Sure. They wrote this article. They were two lawyers. They met at Harvard Law School and became fast friends. And Louis Brandeis moved away from Boston to begin practice, his practice of law, but came back to Boston because his friend Sam Warren kept suggesting that they would be great together if they opened up a law firm together in Boston. Sam Warren was very rich, had these connections. Of course, Louis Brandeis was brilliant. Sam Warren recognized that and recognized that that they were close both in terms of friendship, but also had the same desire to work hard and do a good job in law. And so the two eventually in 1890 decided to write this law review article that they titled The Right to Privacy. And what I found in my research is that the article, the impetus for the article really came from Sam Warren, that he was particularly interested in the right to privacy because the media was very interested in his family. He was a millionaire. He had married the Secretary of State's daughter. He was really good friends with Grover Cleveland. And so they would get together and they would complain about media and media's reporting what they considered private details about their family and otherwise. And so he suggested to Louis Brandeis that they write this this article asking for privacy and suggesting that people needed privacy, as you suggest, to become complete individuals. That in other words, if you think that someone is looking in on you always, if you think that every single thing you do is going to be revealed to other people, you just won't live your best life. You won't be able to explore certain things. You won't be able to make a fool of yourself behind closed doors. And so the article touches on that. It's very much a celebration of privacy and the need for privacy, but it also suggests that the media needs to be curtailed in some way to prevent those sorts of things from being revealed. And what I think is interesting about this is that even though both agreed in letters between them that it was Sam Warren's idea to write the article, Louis Brandeis also has a really intriguing backstory because the article was written in 1890. In the 1880s, Louis Brandeis represented an author, a publishing house, so a book publisher. And the publisher had had published a book titled Cape Cod Folks. And the book was called a novel, except it wasn't. It was real. What had happened was a young woman went to a small town on Cape Cod and agreed to be a teacher there. And so for a couple of years, took very detailed notes about her neighbors, about her students, and thereafter put together what she suggested was a novel that actually accurately reported a lot of things that those individuals in that small town had said and done. Moreover, she used their real names. And so they sued for invasion of their right to privacy in the 1880s. Louis Brandeis, intriguingly, does not represent the people. He represents the publisher. But his argument is that this was indeed an invasion of their privacy. It's just that the law didn't yet recognize that as an invasion of privacy. And so even though the two of them, meaning Warren and Brandeis, write these letters that suggest that Warren is the reason behind the right to privacy, certainly Louis Brandeis had thought about this right as well when he represented the publisher. And highly relevant here to the discussion is that he settled those cases. And so the publisher did not win. Louis Brandeis, representing the book publisher, gave money then to all those people who'd had their private lives revealed in that book. So it's interesting to think about when you think about the language in the right to privacy and the protection for human beings and creativity and self, you have to wonder how much of that language was inspired in part by these people on Cape Cod who had their personal lives revealed in the book. Published by the book publisher, represented by Louis Brandeis.
That goes back pretty far. What was the right to be forgotten, and do you think it's still relevant?
So we think of the right to be forgotten as this very European concept, and yet it's something that's existed in U.S. law as well, and has for a very long time. There's something in law that's in the U.S. called the Restatement, and the Restatement is sort of like a treatise written by law professors, lawyers, and judges suggesting what the law is in the United States. And in 1977, the Restatement authors described what the right to privacy looked like in the United States. And one of the examples that they used was Jean Valjean from Les Miserables. And the Restatement authors suggested that if Javert had ferreted out information about Jean Valjean's past criminal life, So Jean Valjean, 20 years ago, had been convicted of stealing a loaf of bread, say. The Restatement authors say that if that happened 20 years before, and if someone found that out and revealed it to a newspaper, and the newspaper published that information, it could lead to a valid invasion of privacy claim. And so even though we think about this right to be forgotten as being a decidedly European concept inspired by the internet, long before the internet in 1977, there was the suggestion that it existed in U.S. law as well. And the way that's expanding now, intriguingly, is that courts today, some courts, are suggesting that there is a privacy interest in one's criminal past. And there have been courts that have ordered accurate criminal histories removed from the internet because of the very real harm in the present that can be done to people who made mistakes in the past. And so that's a really interesting conflict, again, between truth, between government information that was once known, an arrest, a conviction, versus this privacy interest after a number of years, and the suggestion that that even though it's true, there can be a privacy interest and maybe even a valid claim for invasion of privacy should someone reveal one's criminal past.
Now, journalism is not a profession in the way medicine, law, psychology, and others are. There are no required educational standards or licensing exams for journalists. And we get a lot of our information from so-called citizen journalists. How does, and in your view, how should the law deal with the notion that we're all journalists now?
Well, it's as you suggested, I worked as a journalist for a number of years before I became a lawyer, and I also taught journalism. So I taught in the journalism school at the University of Illinois, and I remember back then this celebration that anyone who wanted to could publish whatever they wanted on the internet. And as you suggest, the mantra was, we're all journalists now, and isn't this great? And the problem is that we're not all journalists, even though it's not a profession, as you suggest. Journalists do abide by ethics codes. And those ethics codes help them make the call what to publish and what not to publish. So for example, I mean, routinely, probably in a number of newsrooms right at this moment, there are discussions about truth and whether or not that truth should be revealed because of the privacy interests on the other side. So there are very strong ethics pulls not to reveal certain things that that a journalist knows that the public would want to know, but the journalist has decided to protect the person on privacy grounds and not to reveal the information. Because publishers on social media and otherwise don't have that same sort of ethics sense, that's how then, and I know you asked about revenge porn as an example previously. That's why these websites came to be that published truth like nude photographs, for example. And so that is not journalism. No journalist would publish such a thing. And because now judges are recognizing that those sorts of websites exist, and that people on social media and otherwise publish a lot of things that journalists wouldn't, you have courts coming down much harder on media, as I suggested earlier, and deciding that that privacy should be respected over truth. In very surprising cases, and in a number of these cases, they literally say It's because of the sorts of things that are revealed on the internet. We need to respect privacy more. We need to find the publisher liable for invading privacy by publishing that sort of thing. And that language, again, can have a very chilling effect on what I like to consider real journalists, those who do struggle with ethics issues and who make the call to publish something that someone doesn't want to have published.
Finally, Amy, your book, Seek and Hide, argues in favor of the need for balance between the dignity of the individual or the family, which impacts their liberty, and freedom of speech and freedom of the press and the public's right to know. But law is a blunt instrument, and you've talked about various legal approaches that are being used now. But how, in your view, should law and public policy address these competing interests, given, or do you have a view of a principle that should be followed for law and public policy to address these issues?
Sure. I'm not afraid of the word dignity. I know that a number of my colleagues are, but I'm not afraid of it. I think that it's an important consideration in invasion of privacy cases to take a look at the dignity of the individual and to make that part of the consideration into whether or not their privacy has been invaded. Without that, you just don't have that protection for person that has existed for a very long time in U.S. law for a very long time, even before 1890. So I like to think of law not as being such a blunt instrument, but at least in that sense, but being more nuanced and balanced, like I try to be in that final chapter. In which I suggest that that dignity should be part of the consideration in invasion of privacy claims. We do that an awful lot in law. We decide what is offensive. We decide what is reasonable and what isn't. And very often we leave it to the juries to make the call. And if we focus on the dignity of the individual, sometimes that will be dangerous. Sometimes a jury might decide that that someone's dignity is at issue, even if they're the president and their tax returns were released. But my hope would be that that the judge in that case or an appellate court would then overturn those interests. So that's what I like to think about. I like to think that maybe the law will go in that direction. And even as someone who celebrates and who cares deeply about press freedom, I don't see that as particularly harmful, knowing just how strong ethics codes are on the journalism side. And how any journalist would be able to well explain why they decided to report some truth that an individual might consider privacy invading.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today, Amy, and for your thoughtful insights on this important and so very timely topic.
Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikov.